It's the 26th of December 2011, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion. And this week is a bit of a special programme, a Hitchmas special, all about the life and work of Christopher Hitchens, who died on the 15th of December. Whilst Hitchens wasn't perfect, and whilst you probably didn't agree with everything he had to say, you at least had to admit that he was a bloody clever bloke, and someone whose work, without doubt, will have had a profound impact on many of our listeners. In this programme, we've got a few reports from our contributors looking back at the different aspects of Hitchens' work. But before we begin, here's Dave Cole taking a look back at his life.
Between his being diagnosed with a cancer that is almost invariably terminal and his sad death, Christopher Hitchens wrote on the order of 60 pieces for just one publication, Slate.com. He also continued to write for The Atlantic, Vanity Fair and others, not to mention continuing to debate live with seemingly all comers. Not only that, we wanted to read and listen to what he had to say. Criticism of religion was a feature of Hitchens' writing long before the prominence he gained through God Is Not Great and The Portable Atheist. He came out swinging in defence of the right of his friend Salman Rushdie to publish the Satanic Verses, and sang harder in opposition, not only to those who would, as he put it, suborn Rushdie's murder, but those in the West who criticised the book rather than the promulgators of fatwas demanding the author's death. Perhaps more famous, or infamous, depending on who you ask, is his opinion on Mother Teresa, not a friend of the poor, but a friend of poverty, that led him to being the devil's advocate at her canonisation, making him, in his words, the first person to represent the evil one, as it were, pro bono. It is for this outspoken atheism and anti-theism, a term he coined, that Hitch will be best known by listeners of The Pod Delusion. To remember him, though, just for that, would do him an injustice. The son, going by his accounts, of a monochrome father and a technicolour mother, duly packed off to boarding school before going to Oxford, Hitchens rapidly became a Soixante-Huitard. In that atmosphere of anger, at everything from Vietnam to nuclear weapons by way of the economic settlement of the day, Hitchens became, at Oxford, a Marxist of the Trotskyite flavour. He would, later in life, somewhat renounce his positions. Then, however, he was something of an enfant terrible, appearing in Cuba by way of lots of protests and the occasional court appearance. His experiences in Cuba, though, stoked the spark of dissent and change within him, having perhaps idolised Cuba, or at least what it represented. The experience of it and some overzealous miners brought a little of the reality of communism home to him. Moreover, the crushing of the Prague Spring made it clear that he could not remain true to himself while maintaining his old positions. Inevitably, he moved to London, where his first job was as a social science correspondent for The Times. Fortunately for all concerned, he only lasted half a year and swiftly moved on to become something of a fixture of the London left-wing literariat, writing from a desk at the New Statesman on matters literary and political. Unsurprisingly, he also frequented a few tables in a few bars and indulged his great passions: alcohol, tobacco, and above all, conversation. Inured to London and wanting the brighter lights of the US, Hitchens moved across the Atlantic in 1981, where he would write for The Nation and later for Vanity Fair, where he would become a contributing editor. There is not time here to go over the vast output in that time in the country that would eventually become his adoptive homeland, except to say that, for anyone who's enjoyed the infamous Hitch Slap, the breadth and depth of subjects he covers with his pen are well worth the effort of reading. It was in that time, though, that he moved further and more definitively away from the politics of his youth. His conversion away from the left seems to have been pushed forward by the events of 9/11 and the ensuing invasion of Iraq. Where he had entered journalism because it allowed him to cover the great breadth of his interests, Hitchens became more focused. 9/11 drove him to oppose what he termed Islamofascism. He supported the war in Iraq, but, perhaps more importantly, what he saw as the milquetoast response of the left to that Islamofascism and to authoritarian regimes. Nor was Hitchens an armchair observer of affairs overseas. As he recalled, he had the experience of walking past groups of the faithful on their way from prayers in Beirut, Baghdad and Belfast. And that's just the bees. Hitchens had been to the region, wherever the region in question was, and counted amongst his friends amongst various Iraqi Kurds, Portuguese dissidents and so on. He never regarded himself as a conservative, referring to temporary allies amongst neoconservatives, although he would have perhaps taken on board Ruskin's consideration of the ridiculousness of the division of parties into liberal and conservative. Certainly, many who remained on the old left were no fans of the drink-soaked ex-Trotskyite Popinjay. Although without much of the clothing of his old politics, he still remained true to his old hatreds of hypocrisy in the 2001 publication of The Trial of Henry Kissinger, and old loves in his much writing on George Orwell, frequently agreeing with him, and giving up what at times verges on apologia for some of his rougher edges. It's somewhat sad that he died shortly before one of his predictions came true, that Kim Jong-il on his death would be replaced by his son, marking the completion of a holy trinity in North Korea. But then Hitchens has moved from an opponent of US interventionism to one of its supporters, from communist to capitalist, from Marxist to Jeffersonian liberal. A crude interpretation might call this hypocrisy or growing conservatism with growing age. I rather think that his opinions changed as his knowledge grew, and that he saw, whether we agree with him or not, differences of the situations of then and now that made the one acceptable and the other morally obligatory. Socialism and communism no longer offered the dynamism and the alternative, whereas the brave new world in which we found ourselves offered the internationalism he always loved. How then to sum up Hitch? Essayist, yes. Debater, yes. Contrarian, conversationalist, journalist, atheist and the rest. All of the above and more would fit, but seemed somehow wanting. And what did he do? Well, speaking truth to power, puncturing and hypocritical, but, above all, enjoying himself on the way. It is probably best just to say that Hitchens was one of the finest public intellectuals of our times, and that his passing takes colour from our lives. Christopher Eric Hitchens, born 13th of April 1949, died 15th of December 2011. For the Pod Delusion, this is David Landon Cole.
Now, I wager that most Pod Delusion contributors are familiar with Hitchens because of his contribution to the genre of slagging off religion. It turns out that he was rather good at it, as Corey Hazelhurst explains.
Christopher Hitchens became best known for his views on religion. In the last decade of his life, he became a celebrity atheist, that most modern of occupations. He gave many speeches, talks, and debated constantly on the subject of religion. Most famously, he debated against Tony Blair last year, when Hitchens opposed the motion that religion was a force for good in the world. In another prominent example, Hitchens and Stephen Fry both debated against Anne Widdecombe and John Onayekan, the Archbishop of Abuja, in an Intelligence Square debate. Hitchens and Fry opposed the motion, the Catholic Church is a force for good in the world, and duly won the debate. These constant debates sprang from his love of arguments. Hitchens once said that he never tired of debating with the religious because, after all, you never know what they're going to say next. The other reason Hitchens was invited to do so many debates and to give so many talks is because he became one of the most prominent members of the so-called New Atheism movement. This movement grew out of a series of books written between 2004 and 2007, including The End of Faith by Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins's The God Delusion. Hitchens's own contribution, God is Not Great, was published in 2007 and became a bestseller. In my view, it's the best work to have come out of the New Atheism movement. It's a more convincing polemic than The End of Faith, in which Sam Harris devotes an odd passage arguing that torture was morally justified in certain circumstances. Hitchens is also more secure when discussing the moral and philosophical case against religion than the God delusion is, which, almost inevitably, given Dawkins's background, is written from a scientific perspective. A feature of the New Atheists was that its members were more hostile to the idea of religion than previous secularists. Previous authors who had attacked established religion were often deists, people like Voltaire and Thomas Paine, who believed that there was a God, but constantly attacked the inconsistencies and contradictions of religious texts. Bog-standard atheism, for want of a better way of putting it, is just an absence of belief in God rather than a hostility to religion per se. The New Atheists took this a step further. Not only did they believe there was no God, but that religion could often be immoral and harmful to mankind. Hitchens used to describe this view as anti-theism. The subtitle of God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, sounds like a hyperbolic strapline from a publisher designed to sell more copies. But Hitchens explained that this genuinely was his view. He repeatedly argued that the only way to get good people to do evil things was by using religion. The example that Hitchens often cited for this view was circumcision. Cutting off the foreskin of a young boy, or the clitoris of a young girl, was profoundly immoral when performed on a child who could not give adequate consent and could often lead to medical complications. Furthermore, there was no logic in doing so without authorization in religious scripture. Hitchens wrote in God Is Not Great that if religion and its arrogance were not involved, no healthy society would permit this primitive amputation or allow any surgery to be practiced on the genitalia without the full and informed consent of the person involved. In a similar vein, Hitchens argued that religion gave people a license to hate that they would not otherwise enjoy. In his obituary of Jerry Falwell, the notorious American preacher, Hitchens wrote that there is no vileness that cannot be freely uttered by a man whose name is prefaced with the word reverend. Falwell had gone on television to say that the Antichrist was on earth and was an adult Jewish male, and that America had brought the 9/11 attacks upon itself by tolerating homosexuality. Hitchens thought that there was no way anyone could have been invited onto television to utter these views were they not backed up by a religious faith. No discussion of Hitchens's views on religion can be complete without mentioning his polemic against Mother Teresa of Calcutta. In 1994, Hitchens produced a documentary about her, Hell's Angel, which is definitely worth watching on YouTube, and this was expanded in a later book called The Missionary Position. In the book and the documentary, Hitchens argued that Teresa was the roving ambassador of a highly politicised papacy. This could be seen in her campaigning against contraception and abortion. In her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, Mother Teresa described abortion as the greatest threat to peace today. Hitchens also criticised Mother Teresa for taking money and giving support to dictators such as the Duvalier family of Haiti, and convicted fraudsters such as Charles Keating. Hitchens's work on Mother Teresa was outrageous in the best sense of the word. It was typical Hitchens the iconoclast, never letting things like popular consensus or good taste get in the way of making a good argument. By his own admission, none of Hitchens's books, even God Is Not Great, quite do justice to the high regard in which he is held. Hitchens himself thought that only his literary essays, found in collections such as Unacknowledged Legislation, would be read after his death. That verdict is perhaps too pessimistic. In my view, he will be best known for the debates, talks, and speeches he gave, especially those on religion, which will be watched on YouTube long after his death. In that sense, for all his espoused Liberal Enlightenment values, Hitchens was perhaps the first and best atheist of the internet age. This was Corey Hazelhurst for The Pod Delusion.
When the news of Hitchens' death broke on Twitter, many people tagged their posts with the title of his best-known book, God Is Not Great. Naturally, this drew many kind, thoughtful, compassionate and sympathetic messages from Christian tweeters. Here is a selection. News Awareness. Gladys Shaw.
God is not great. Whoever created that trending topic must die today.
He did. Compassion.
Homo Sage.
Whoever thinks God is not great should go kick rocks with an open-toed shoe.
Diamond Princess.
God is not great. Whichever idiot agrees with this needs two kicks in the arse and four backhand, etc.
Zach Lerner.
Whoever likes God is not great, please come meet me and let me personally give you the biggest arse kicking of your life.
Now, in addition to being good at arguing about contemporary things, Hitchens was also known for his work as a historian. In this next report, Richard Godby here argues that Hitchens was in fact a Marxist historian. I'm sure there's a joke in here somewhere about a spectre haunting Europe, but I understand that he wasn't really into ghosts. Here's the ironically named Richard Godby here with more.
Christopher Hitchens was a great polymath. His breadth of knowledge of areas from philosophy and religion to physics and social theory was staggering. But the core of his knowledge, in some ways the centre of all he did, was his work on politics and history. Hitchens' politics have, are and will be gone over in great detail elsewhere. So I'd like a brief look at his work on history. I want to look at Hitch the historian. Firstly, it has to be noted that his politics and his vast historical knowledge cannot be separated. Hitchens wrote works on Thomas Paine. He wrote on Thomas Jefferson, Henry Kissinger, Mother Teresa and others. And he was far from what we historians would call Rankian. He didn't simply take the documents as he found them, drawing an objective conclusion from what they told him at all. He hit his subjects with the full force of his political and ideological beliefs, delivering not only accuracy but a message. And the message was the important thing. This doesn't mean he made it all up. Far from it. He used Mother Teresa, for example, as a figurehead for all that's wrong with the Catholic Church. That's true. Her and its love of poverty, while her and it dubiously acquired great wealth, and her and its obsession with an impossible to sustain chastity over the practicality and real benefits of birth control, are an example of how he used her in that way. Nevertheless, his work was meticulous, well-researched, and flawlessly argued. As he puts it himself, he judged Mother Teresa's reputation by her actions and words, rather than her actions and words by her reputation. He discovered that the public picture of Teresa was a fairy tale, a swirl of fiction cleverly spun around an imperfect, indeed extremely flawed, human being. Equally, in his biography of Thomas Paine, he draws the picture of a man at odds with blind faith, blaming it for slavery and blaming Christian proselytization as the cause of the theft of Native American lands. Those Christians were painting a picture of the monstrous savage in order to justify purely financial gain. This, while clearly echoing his modern political sensibilities in a way that would cause most historians to wince, may not be far from the truth. Paine did indeed ridicule missionaries who attempted to convert Native Americans, and he did clearly state in The Rights of Man that reason and ignorance influence the great bulk of mankind. Reason obeys itself, and ignorance submits to whatever is dictated to it. Hitchens did not pluck his history from the ether in an almost postmodern way, however much he filtered it to make a philosophical point. He would not overstep the bounds. He would not lie, although he was prone to the occasional error. It leads me to a question of what kind of a historian he was. Well, firstly, he was a political historian. As I've already said, politics was at the centre of everything he did, and that included history and his politics were inextricable. But perhaps more importantly is the question, how did he write his history? If there's one method of historiography that can be fitted to Christopher Hitchens, it would be that of a Marxist historiographer. Before hundreds of people tell me that he was no Marxist at the point of his death, wave his support of George W. Bush in my face and the war, and scream about his move to the right, let me differentiate between someone who used the techniques of Marxist historiography or historical materialism and a Marxist. You don't have to be one to be the other. Historical materialism is about seeing the world through materialist eyes. It's about rejecting any notion of ideas appearing from some kind of ether or metaphysics or revelation, and acknowledging that the root cause of everything is in modes of production, or, to put more simply, what we have to do to put food in our mouths. From this angle, the infrastructure of the real world always has influence on the superstructure of the ideological world. The latter cannot exist without pressure from the former. And this is Hitchens to his core. When he said, that he still had a Marxist heart beating inside a couple of years ago. I don't think he meant literally Marxist. I think he meant he still had respect for the ideas of Karl Marx. When discussing the Bible, for example, the backbone to his astonishment at the belief of others in that book and its teachings were a desperate attempt by him to explain the material reality from which this corpus of ancient fables had arisen. He also liked to try and explain the material economic realities that forced Constantine to become Christian, and the very real social forces that made the Nicene Creed get together and agree to a Godhead Trinitarian version of Christ rather than a human one. His work on Thomas Jefferson is equally littered with references to the economic reality of his situation, be it his wish to avoid conflict for economic reasons, the influence of his personal economics on his thought, or the powerful reality of the tobacco slave economy on which America rested. When ideology was claimed as the primary instigating force in decision-making, Hitchens would, more often than not, go on the attack. Kissinger's use of ideology to create a regime that, as Hitchens put it, can guarantee safe investment by virtue of a ban on trade unions, a slave labour prison system, and a one-party ideology, was one example of this rejection of anyone who tried to impose superstructure on infrastructure, or to impose ideology on actuality for personal, political, or financial gain. This was the core of his history and the thrust of his argument. His materialist political history would often get him into trouble. When he used it to take Kissinger and Mother Teresa to task, he was accused of intellectual snobbery. He responded, only if the task of intellectuals is to urge Mr. and Mrs. Average to settle for little or for less. This is what makes Hitchens' work on history all the more compelling. His history was clever. It's not aimed at the Time Team watching, full-colour BBC hardback tabletop book on the Royals of England reading public. He wanted people to think, to challenge, and to be challenged. He wasn't writing who did what to who and when. He was making the case for materialism, for secularism, by exploring the material reality of the past. Throughout his life, Christopher Hitchens had something to say, and through his works on history, as elsewhere, he was damn well going to say it.
Sympathy. Madoka Mitsui.
God is not great. Whoever started this trend should f***ing get a punch in the face.
Gina Cruz.
If you're really coming up with reason why God is not great, kill yourself.
All compassion. Vivian Nguyen.
Whoever is agreeing with the TT God is not great should be smack upside the head with a shovel.
Joy Cayley.
All you God is not great advocates, I'd love to put a bullet in each of your heads.
Matthew MS7.
Whoever started the God is not great trend needs to be kicked in the face with steel-tipped boots.
Wakiki.
God is not great? Oh, what the hell? Whoever came up with this TT needs to be shot 99 times.
Now, one of the most controversial aspects of Hitchens' life was after 9/11, when rather than being anti-war like all of the cool kids, he aligned himself with Bush and Blair in supporting the war with Iraq. Which was a bit of a shame. I suppose it's as disappointing, for instance, as if it turns out that, David Attenborough was a Nazi sympathiser. With more on Hitchens and not Attenborough, here's Mohammed Fahad, as read by Alex Foster.
Christopher Hitchens was many things to many people. He was a contrarian, a rationalist hero, a champion of human rights around the world, a turncoat, especially to those on the traditional left and to some, even a right-wing warmonger. While most people can be viewed in these contradictory terms, that's probably more of a comment on the polarised nature of public discourse these days, few manage to embody them in the way Christopher Hitchens did. And that's why reading the various gushing, eulogistic and, dare I say it, uncritical pieces on his life and legacy this past week did make me a tad uncomfortable. Don't get me wrong, I love Hitch, and I certainly recognise the need for respecting the recently deceased, and I don't even have a problem with accentuating the positives. However, I do think there is a limit to this sort of thing before it starts to sound a bit contrived. For example, his friend Ian McEwan defended his Iraq war stance with words to the effect of, well, he was always against totalitarianism, you see. That's what motivated his Iraq views. Even people who disagree with him on the war should recognise that. I don't buy this at all. For two reasons. Firstly, because it's a meaningless platitude to trot out, saying that you're against totalitarianism. It's a bit like saying, well, I believe that goodness is good and badness is bad. Where's my Nobel Peace Prize? There is no explanatory justifications in statements like these. Sure, the rhetoric is very seductive and theatrically satisfying, but ultimately meaningless platitudes are a force for drowning out and diluting legitimate investigation, and that is a charge that can be levelled at people who are singing his praises today, as well as the man himself when he was alive. The second reason is because it implies that most of the anti-war crowd was in it because they were somehow infatuated with Saddam Hussein. No one, to my mind, made the case against the war based on this premise. Even George Galloway, who was infamously filmed crawling up Saddam's derriere a few years prior, was careful enough not to make that mistake. Yet the answer seemed to not only satisfy his friends, but apparently the anchors who questioned them as well. The fact of the matter is that Christopher Hitchens was quite the hawk throughout his career. He was always arguing for liberal interventionism, whether it was in Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, or even Iran. He didn't have a sudden shift in thinking as many in the left like to pretend. They like to think that, I guess, because it is more comforting for them to believe that Hitch sold out rather than the fact that he was always inclined to break away, so to speak. Part of what made him a compelling and powerful voice on the scene was his ability to spot nonsense on the left, to embarrass them and to point to the hypocrisies and feeble compromises and the orthodoxy they were guilty of. The fall of Soviet Union was a particularly tricky affair for those espousing the mainstream left view on politics. But post 9/11, Hitch was also guilty of over-egging this instinct. I would urge you to go back to around 2001 and 2 and look up some of the debates he was having around the issue. You'll find that in most cases when he was engaging with people on the left, like Noam Chomsky, Tariq Ali and the like, his one trick was to accuse them of being sympathetic to Islamo-fascism. My concern is not that he was harsh on them. Indeed, both Chomsky and especially Ali are capable of suffering from tunnel vision. It is that he is simply taking down straw men. The atrocity of 9/11 created a reactionary atmosphere in the West. This was the time where rational heads needed to prevail. I'm not arguing for whitewashing the crimes of Al-Qaeda, militant Islam, or even the Taliban, but it was a time to also appraise the situation as critically and objectively as possible. To expect that of politicians is unrealistic, but I think people like Hitch, who promoted themselves as bastions of rational thinking and rufflers of powerful feathers, it is not unreasonable to expect better. Indeed, he became a cheerleader for both Iraq and Afghanistan wars, and the most prominent face of the clash of civilization idea. As someone who spent his life in both the West and Muslim world, I can't help but think that satisfying this notion requires a lot of cognitive dissonance and a hugely cherry-picked view of life in both the West and the Muslim world. This reductionist view that populations in the Middle East and South Asia are the way they are because their entire edifice is created from Bronze Age religious texts. If only they could be exposed to opera, P.G. Wodehouse and Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. There was no appreciation for complexity, of colonial legacies, of economic disparities, of even various factions that exist in the Muslim world. Talking about them in such uniform terms is utterly ludicrous, but in the end he had no choice but to push this line to reconcile his views of the wars. I don't think that that is somebody we ought to be celebrating as an icon of rationality. Latterly, he was more famous for taking on God. There were great laughs along the way as he tore ridiculous clergymen and pseudo-scientists a new one every time. Was he reverting to picking on low-hanging fruit? I don't know, but I do think that if we are honestly going to assess his legacy in the skeptic movement, we have to talk about the dodgy Hitchens alongside the devastatingly articulate one. We have to also realize being articulate doesn't necessarily equate to being rational. Hitchens, himself, was never one for eulogistic nostalgia, and perhaps the best way to honour him is to remember him in his totality, and not just a cherry-picked version, which makes us smile. These have been the words of Mohammed Farhad, trying to be the Grinch at Hitchmas, for The Pod Delusion. Read by Alex Foster.
Family Values. Risha TTG.
God is not great. Whoever thought this trend up should kill their whole family, including themselves.
Will Easy 22.
Whoever made this trending topic, God is not great, should burn in hell, and your whole family.
Sensitivity. Brittany Lachey.
whoever started the trend God is not great needs to be shot in the throat.
Continuing on Iraq, our final report on Hitchin's work is by David Eastman, who is particularly interested in the book Regime Change.
The book Regime Change is a thin tome, about 100 pages of essays, released in 2003, concerning the months leading up to the Iraq War. To put that in historical context, the World Trade Towers had been destroyed a couple of years earlier, and Mark Zuckerberg had hacked together something called FaceMash. I'll let Mr. Hitchin's introduce his own work.
This is an experiment in the uses of journalism, or the usefulness of it. At the cresting of the argument over regime change in Iraq, when it began to seem that the United States government was finally and seriously committed to the policy, I started to write a series of polemics for the online magazine Slate. The essays were concerned primarily with the West's attitude to Saddam Hussein, Iraq's contrary and occasionally murderous despot. The term regime change itself implied that an unwanted dictatorship could be replaced, much like a light bulb. Hitchin's argued that Saddam was bad for Iraq as well as for the West, that the role of armchair general was valid, that imperialism from the US was justified in this case, and that Halliburton was preferable to Hussein. Al-Qaeda gets a mention, though no link was made with Iraq. He argued that needing to find WMD was in itself a sign that as no one trusted the regime, it might as well be changed. Hitchin's was previously associated with the left, but these pro-invasion opinions would certainly have been considered a divorce. As a small taste, let's look at the arguments for what was referred to as a just war. The idea was that the West should only be seen to start a war if it was all good. Hitchin's attacked the previous Democrat President Jimmy Carter as being a peanut czar and a Baptist big mouth for pointing out that aerial bombardment would inevitably involve collateral damage, as military targets were unhelpfully near schools and hospitals, etc. Carter attempted to attach Christianity to his viewpoint, something Hitch formulated against. People getting killed was no reason to reconsider invasion in his mind. And to be fair, the Bible does seem to include a lot of God-sanctioned slaughter. There are immediately three problems with this book before you even open it, simply brought on by hindsight. The obvious one is that the last of these essays stops just after the successful invasion, which we now know was just the false dawn preceding one of the most disastrous occupations in history. A deeper problem is that as the rhetoric of the war on terror ramped up, Christopher Hitchin's, who was always rather generous of his time, found himself welcomed by a febrile media, wishing to broadcast as many cogent anti-Islamic views as they could find. While his interest was anti-clerical in nature, it was nevertheless fairly easy to find him airing views that sounded suspiciously racist. It's hard to talk about the worth of a headmaster if we suspect he might be a pederast, and similarly, it's hard to persuade ourselves that the lives of Iraqis were safe with Hitchin's. Perhaps the ultimate problem is that we take it as a given that the Iraq War was wrong. That leads us to assume it was self-evidently wrong from the start. But even if we were to mark these essays as some sort of failure, it's worth remembering the value of this polemic. How did Winston Churchill manage to persuade the average Englishman in the 1930s, in a time when most people did no international travel, that what the Germans were doing in Poland was a threat to Europe? He needed to do a lot of convincing in the face of natural reaction to do nothing. Today we take it as a given that fighting the Nazis was right, and that leads us to assume it was self-evidently right from the start. But perhaps without Mr. Churchill's pro-war leanings, it is not certain Britain would have entered the war at all, or would have been late, like the US. So it might take a little longer for history to posthumously smile on Hitchin's, the pro-war controversialist, but that shouldn't stop us praising his strong arguments and willingness to face down popular intransigence. You should probably look elsewhere for an atheist poster boy, but reading his work will definitely stretch your mind. This has been David Eastman for the Pod Delusion.
Conspiracy. Young E. Mack.
What in the f*** is this Illuminati arse trending topic? God is not great.
Precision.
Cristiano Santos.
Whoever encourages that trending topic, hope your ass burns at 45757575795 degrees in hell.
Articulation. Jesse Prolific.
The son of a that trended this God is not great will burn in hell, you stupid
Marina Kelly.
Who the would make a TT saying God is not great? What the is wrong with you? Without God, you wouldn't even be here, stupid.
Now, finally, you'll have spotted that throughout this programme, Sean Ellis has been reading out some of the tweets made by Hitchens' detractors on the day after his death. If you were on Twitter that day, you might remember that a conspiracy theory developed claiming that Twitter had censored the hashtag GodIsNotGreat. Personally, I prefer the conspiracy theory that I tried to start, that Peter Hitchens was just Christopher doing a character, but alas, this was debunked merely hours later. Here's Dave Cross with more.
On Friday morning, I woke to the terrible but not entirely unexpected news that Christopher Hitchens had died, but my mood was lightened somewhat when I saw that Hitch had one last trick up his sleeve. As with most breaking news these days, I found out about his death from Twitter. I checked my Twitter feed as I got up at about 6 a.m. A few people that I follow were already awake and discussing it. As a mark of respect, many of those tweets were tagged with the name of what is probably Hitchens' best-known book, God is Not Great. Slowly, more and more people joined in with this, and before too long, the hashtag God is Not Great was listed as one of Twitter's worldwide trending topics. At that point, it all started to get a bit weird. All around the world, religious people who knew nothing at all about Christopher Hitchens, his books, or his death, were looking at Twitter and seeing the tag God is Not Great, and that annoyed many of them immensely, so they started tweeting on the subject. Their tweets seemed to largely fall into three categories. Firstly, there were the confused tweets along the lines of, what is this and why is it trending? Someone called Chanel Number 5 wrote, why is God is Not Great trending? They must have made a typo and meant to say God is great. Secondly, there were attempts to inject their own beliefs into the stream. Someone called Foolish Denise, and no, I'm not making this up, wrote, you're right, God is not great, he's the greatest. Finally, and most disappointingly, there were threats to kill whoever had started the hashtag. I seriously want to kill whoever started the God is not great, wrote Shatsy97, which is all very Christian. Of course, all of these new tweets all included the hashtag, so that just helped ensure that the hashtag became even more popular. Hitchens fans replied politely, pointing out why the hashtag was trending and inviting them to read the book, and the hashtag was tweeted and retweeted and commented on and argued over more than pretty much any other hashtag that I've followed all year. For most of the morning, the tweet deck column I had set up to follow the tag was moving far too quickly for me to follow it. At some point in the morning, the hashtag disappeared from the list of trending topics. Some people claimed that Twitter had censored it in response to the Christian death threats, and that's a branch of the debate that is still getting comments and retweets. One of the most retweeted examples comes from John Willander, who says, God is not great pulled from trends because Christians protest, but reasons to beat your girlfriend was allowed. Stay classy, Twitter. This conspiracy theory leapt up almost immediately after the hashtag vanished from the list of trending topics. As far as I can see, none of the people repeating this claim have any evidence to back it up, which is more than somewhat ironic, given Hitchens' evidence-driven view of the world. The argument seems to go like this. At one point the hashtag was trending, then Christians got upset and started making death threats aimed at the people who started the trend. Soon after that the hashtag was no longer trending, therefore Twitter must have given in to Christian bullying and censored the hashtag. Whilst it all sounds frighteningly plausible, I hope I don't have to spell out the flaws in the logic. If you can't work it out for yourself, then I recommend the Wikipedia article on correlation does not imply causation. I could be wrong here. There might be some irrefutable piece of evidence proving conclusively that Twitter deliberately censored the hashtag. If there is, then I haven't seen it, and I'll be grateful to anyone who could bring it to my attention. There is, however, some evidence that Twitter didn't censor the hashtag. On Friday morning, as the debate was still raging, a Facebook friend in Canada pointed out that it was still trending there. In the middle of the afternoon, someone else pointed out that it was trending in San Francisco. So if Twitter were censoring it, they weren't doing a very good job. There was even someone who apparently works for Twitter who said that they didn't do it. Of course, none of this is conclusive evidence that Twitter didn't censor the hashtag, but balancing some evidence for non-censorship against absolutely no evidence at all for the censorship, I know which side I come out on. all of which leaves us searching for an explanation for the sudden disappearance. And to be honest, I don't think we really need to look too hard. Things stop being trending topics all the time. Things have to drop out of the list so that new things can come in. Otherwise the list would constantly be full of nonsense about Justin Bieber and Twilight. The Twitter trending topics algorithm can't possibly just measure the popularity of topics. That would be incredibly dull. Instead, what it does is to look for changes in popularity. A steady buzz of the same few million people talking about a particular topic doesn't get noticed, but a sudden increase in the number of people discussing the same topic does. The official Twitter blog has an entry saying pretty much exactly that. I'm sure that this won't convince the conspiracy theorists. Ah, they'll say. That's all very convenient, but it just gives Twitter an easy way to cover up their censorship. Which is true, I suppose, but it's hardly a basis for a rational discussion. And that's the most disappointing thing to come out of this affair. The people making these accusations are fans of Christopher Hitchens. You would hope they'd be from the more rational end of the spectrum. You'd hope that they would be above making accusations like this without evidence, but I guess no one is immune from irrationality. But I'm going to go out on a limb here and lay my cards on the table. Another cliché is that Hitchens would despise. Twitter probably didn't censor the God is not great hashtag. I should point out that when John Willander, the author of the much-retweeted tweet I quoted a couple of minutes ago, wrote a blog post about the incident, he also seemed to accept that his original opinion was wrong. But the reaction from the religious Twitter crowd when they first saw God is not great listed as a trending topic is still very interesting. One tweet in particular from Luke T. Adams summed things up for me. He wrote, "Hitchens dies, his book God is Not Great trends, religious people threaten violence, the point of his book is proven, Hitchens for the win." It's tempting to imagine Hitchens looking down on the storm that his death has caused and laughing, but of course that would go against everything that he believed in. So don't do that. Instead, reread his articles, buy his books, watch videos of him demolishing his opponents in debate, and raise a glass in memory of Christopher Hitchens. This has been Dave Cross reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Apologetic. One gutter.
F*** Twitter tonight for posting this devil-ass trending topic, God is not great. F*** those who chose to help trend it. God bless.
Jingoism. Alex Henriquez.
I find out God is not great as a trending topic. What the f***? This isn't f***ing Iraq or Russia or some s***. This is America.
And finally, self-defeat. Feed me racks.
I don't want to have anything to do with this trending topic. Hash God is not great.
Well, thanks very much to everyone there for basically proving Hitch's point for him. This is Sean Ellis, wading through the Hitch tags for the Pod Delusion.
And that's it for our Hitchmas special, Pod is Not Great. And I can't think of any more puns on Hitchens' work or name, so if you've got any more, leave them in the comments on our website. And do head over to poddelusion.co.uk, where you can listen to over 2 years of archives of our regular weekly programme, as well as follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook and all of that sort of thing. If you're feeling kind, and need I remind you that Winterval is the season of goodwill, you can also make donations to the Pod Delusion, as well as sign up to subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All that's at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dave Cole, Corey Hazelhurst, Richard Godbehere, Mohammed Fahad, Alex Foster, David Eastman, Dave Cross, and me, James O'Malley. The music was by Milton Myrmikides, and was chosen because in an interview we found with Hitchens, he cited his favourite musicians as Bach and Bob Dylan. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
One of the most wicked ideas ever preached, and one that's ruined the lives and the peace of mind of many, many children, preached to them by vicious, child-hating old men and women in the name of this ghastly cult. I don't need 2 minutes to finish with this religion, but thanks.
This is disgraceful. It's inhuman. It's obscene. And it comes from a clutch of hysterical, sinister virgins who've already betrayed their charge in the children of their own church. For shame. For shame. I'm not going to have any of that. Enough with clerical and religious bullying and intimidation.
Is that finally clear? Have I got that across? Thank you.